So here are my comments. What can I say about Edward Osborne Wilson that hasn't already been said? That he is one of the world's preeminent biologists who has helped us all understand the extraordinary richness of life on this planet and how it is threatened by human activity. That he has been one of the great teachers at Harvard who has inspired countless numbers of students and colleagues. That he is one of the great science writers of our time, winner of two Pulitzer Prizes, uniquely able to translate complex scientific concepts into language we all can understand. That he has received our nation's highest science award, the National Medal of Science, the prestigious Crawford Prize from the Royal Swedish Academy of Science, 60 other prizes, medals, and awards, 24 honorary degrees, and the selection in an international poll in 1996 as one of the 100 most influential scientists of all time. His seminal studies with ants and other organisms are the gold standard for research in evolutionary biology and ecology. That his brilliant inquiring mind has illuminated concepts such as biodiversity, a term he coined or helped coin, biophilia, the notion that we are hardwired to need to be in the presence of nature, sociobiology, the study of the biological basis of social behavior, island biogeography, the concept that the number of species on islands and their extinction rate is a function of area and distance from the mainland, and most recently, consilience, the concept that everything in our world is organized in terms of a small number of fundamental laws that comprise the principles underlying every branch of learning. I can say that when we at the Center for Health and the Global Environment were thinking about who would be our first Global Environmental Citizen Award, there was no question that it would be Ed Wilson. Ed.
To embrace the concept of the living environment, the natural environment, and its preservation, saving the creation. And now I hear from my distinguished colleague that he and I are on the same wavelength in approaching the religious community and sort of trying to engage them, regardless of what possible metaphysical differences may exist, engage them in saving the creation. Well, I don't want to get too far off the subject, which is that of biodiversity, biological diversity, what it is, its status, and its importance, and what we can do to understand it better, to save it, and to make maximum use of it in the future for humanity. I think our relation to the rest of life can be summarized very briefly, in a nutshell, by saying that the diversity of life is far greater, or seen today after several decades of research, as far greater, far richer than ever before imagined. And at the same time, we now have increasingly firm figures, if we needed them, to show that the rate at which those species are disappearing and the ecosystems that sustain them and that they compose are disappearing at an accelerating rate, that can be stopped. We can learn a lot more about biodiversity to the benefit of science and humanity. And if we do not do this, the loss that is undergoing now will inflict a very heavy price in wealth, security, and in spirit. I think this 21st century is going to be known as a century of the environment. It's useful to employ the metaphor of the bottleneck. We're in a bottleneck. Humanity is in a bottleneck, which is due to the still rapidly increasing population of the Earth and, of course, rising per capita consumption. And our goal should be to get through that bottleneck, come out the other end with a decent standard of living for all, environmental stability, and having brought through as much of the rest of life with us as possible. To me, that is a great goal of the 21st century. Because if you can achieve those two great goals, then you'll be achieving a great deal else of what humanity thinks of as its noblest goals. There is some hope that we actually will make it through that bottleneck, in spite of the understandable pessimism of so many people. One of them is that we are approaching an end to the population explosion. It turns out, I'm not your average liberal Harvard professor in saying this, but it just turns out that when women are liberated, are empowered, and have control of their own lives, including their reproductive lives, and some hope for their own future, the fertility rate plummets. And it has correspondingly plummeted in the last 40 years from about six, this is globally, six children per woman, to three per woman. The break point is 2.1 children per woman, and that is the 0.1, of course, is the insurance. That's you have to have that 0.1 for cover child mortality. And all the European, Western European countries, I mean Eastern as well, are now below breakpoint. And the lowest, I believe, the figure I've seen is 1.1 or 1.2. The lowest is Italy. And several of the European countries are now in negative population growth. And it's the trend is now popping up in the Asian tigers, the economically rapidly advancing Asian countries, including, surprisingly, maybe not to people who've been there, but surprisingly, Thailand. So the best figures are, the ones I'm aware of, from the United Nations Population Services, is that we will peak under present trends at about 9 billion per year, 9 billion total standing population by the end of the century. And then we'll start coming down. And that being kept in mind, it's not much, too much to hope that this planet can be turned into a paradise. Now, we really have to start moving on this. I mean, humanity has to do better than it has been. It's begun to move in the right direction. It's got to be doing a lot better. Because the damage already done is irreparable. It cannot be repaired in any period of time that has meaning to the human mind. And the reason for this is that unless we can find a way to start creating artificial species and building artificial ecosystems, which in my mind would be an abomination, because then everything has to be filtered through the human mind and the human imagination, and the natural world is so much more interesting, so much more varied, so much more surprising, so much deeper in complexity than anything the human mind can at this time invent, this would be a terrible way of opting out, of taking action now to save what we have inherited. The average extinction rate before humanity came along was one species, paleontologists tell us, one species per million species per year. And the average extinction rate was that. I'm sorry, that was the average extinction rate, and the average birth rate was that as well. So there was a kind of a balance. Now we have upped the extinction rate to, the most conservative figure is 100 times over base level. And almost certainly it is order of magnitude 1,000 times. And I would expect that the more we learn, and certainly the farther the process continues into the 21st century, it will soon be order of magnitude 10,000 times. So a common figure used by some pretty somber and careful experts on this subject is that the Earth, the number of species on Earth could be cut in half by the end of this century. What is biodiversity? Now let me go on now to that part. It is the commonality of heritable variation, either globally or locally. And we cut it, so we slice it horizontally into three levels of biological organization. Illustrated here, the top, where we see at the top the ecosystems, such as shallow marine, mangrove, rainforest, grassland, and so on. The next level, which goes all the way to the bottom here, showing organisms different, species of different physical size, is the species that compose the ecosystems. And then the lowermost level, of course, is the variety of genes that prescribe the traits of each one of these species. How much is there? This is an out-of-date figure that I have at top, although the proportionality is about the same, of known species described, given a scientific name by biologists. And that was when I first put that together in the late 80s, about 1.4 million known. That's just an estimate because we don't know. We've never done a full accounting of how many species have been described by science, but it was about 1.4 then. Now we put it somewhere between 1.5 and 1.8 million known and having a scientific name, given a binomial Latinized name, probably closer to 1.8. And this is the way you can think about it if you, in the speciescape cartoon, where species numbers for a given group are indicated by the proportion of them are indicated by the size of a representative organism, so that this gigantic beetle represents the maybe 800,000 known species of insect, and it looms over a little elephant there representing the 5,000 known species of mammals, and so on. Now, the important point here is that we are pretty much in the dark as to how many species there are, how much biodiversity is on the Earth at the species level. Estimates have ranged from an impossibly low, which now should be seen to be impossibly low, 3.6 million to over 100 million. A minimum now, I think most would agree, would be 10 million to 100 million or more, order of magnitude. To show you how little we know, consider fungi. I think there are about 60,000 species of fungi formally described and named, but estimates put it, the actual number is in excess of 1.5 million. Then there's the nematode worms, known to many of you by their representative C. elegans. There are about 16,000 nematode worms, these tiny, squiggly little creatures that are shown right above that, to the left of that shell there. About 16,000. And the actual number of nematode worms almost certainly goes into the millions. These are the most abundant animals on Earth. They make up 4 out of every 5 animals on Earth, nematode worms. They occupy an enormous range of habitats, microhabitats, and niches. It's been said of them that if we removed all solid matter off the surface of the Earth except for nematode worms, that you'd see the vague outline of most of it in nematode worms. And what do we know about nematode worms? Next to nothing. This is an unexplored, a largely unexplored group. The vast majority of species, thus, are still unknown to science. Even they have not been diagnosed, they have not been given scientific names, they have not begun to have a record accumulated on them. But all of this pales to insignificance before the dark matter of Earth's biodiversity, the prokaryotes, and especially the bacteria. The known number of species of bacteria, the last figure I have, I'm sure this has grown substantially, but still not much, compared to other groups, is 5,688 known and having some sort of codified name or designation, 5,688, October of 2002. But you have just about that many in a gram of rich garden soil, and which you, in other words, dirt you can hold in the palm of your hand. When you do that, when you take a gram, you have about 10 billion bacteria, and they represent somewhere roughly 5,000 to 6,000 species, virtually all of which are unknown to science. A recent estimate published in Nature, holds that in a ton of fertile soil, you would expect in the vicinity of 4 million species of bacteria, virtually all unknown to science. Now, it can be shown that from samples, if virtually every one of those species, maybe everyone, absolutely, is beautifully adapted to some environment or other, microhabitat. It occupies a niche, which is defined in the temperature and the nutrient conditions and the pH and what is there that can consume it, and so on and on. And we don't know anything about this. This is the foundation of the world, the microbial base that we live on, and virtually nothing known about it. Of course, the reason many of you will know is they're so difficult to culture. And now that barrier is broken with sequencing. And I was just up visiting my new colleague, Richard Roberts, at the New England Bio Lab, and we were talking about the species problem. And he said, well, we now can sequence a bacterium genome in 4 hours. And before long, we will be able to cut that very substantially. So it won't be long before we'll be able to do what I've seen done recently in another biotech lab in San Diego, of Diversa, of micropipetting out a single bacterium. And say you would go like on a field trip looking for warblers, and you can actually go down into a biofilm, one of these complex aggregates of biobacterial masses, or off the surface of a grain of sand, which magnified adequately to show bacteria would look like the Apennine Mountains, and you could pluck out one bacterium and put it into a microtubule of nutrients. Or you could take a large sample of them and get them into an array of microtubules with different nutrients and find how to multiply them, and very shortly, and you might even do this from a single bacterium, be able to sequence it. So this, you know, the technology is racing ahead, and we're about to open up the microbial world and all that that entails. And we have before us huge technical and conceptual problems and interesting problems. What is a bacterial species? No one can settle on what it is. There's so much gene transfer back and forth among bacterial species, for example, and so many of them are just asexual. We don't know how to define a bacterial species, and yet they surely exist because of the discontinuities in the genomes among cultures that can be made out of these ecosystems. And what are they doing? What are the laws that determine their diversity and so on and on? You know, I wrote a memoir in 1994 called Naturalist, and I concluded the book with a paragraph saying, if I could start all over again, what would I be? And I said, a microbial ecologist. I think I'd still go. If I could be magically transformed into a 25-year-old PhD or MD student, there's no question where I'd head right now. Okay, well, I've been too long on professional recruitment, Eric. I've got to, and I'm not even a bacterial microbiologist. I've got to move on. And I will, therefore, not dwell on the genome. This is the total genome of a very small virus versus that of a human. This panel shows one part of the human genome and that's just DNA molecules you see there, out of 2,500, and I could go on with fascinating estimates and descriptions of just how vast that genome is in terms of information and the like, but I will not dwell there, particularly in a group that's well-versed in genomics and the human heredity, I hope. Where is biodiversity located? Everywhere there is liquid water, or the potential of liquid water, pole to pole, from the summit of Everest to the Challenger Deep at 36,000 feet below the ocean surface. At the very least, there are bacteria and usually microscopic fungi present. With microscopic fungi, that's a really interesting suite of organisms. They turn up everywhere. There are microscopic fungi in Lake Vostok, the deep subterranean lake that's been isolated for into the order of a million years by the Antarctic ice shelf. There are bacteria there, we now know, and microscopic fungi. There are microscopic fungi among the slimes. That's an acronym for subterranean litho-autotrophic microbial ecosystems. Slimes. Fairly new to biology. Beneath the surface of the earth and going down as much as 2 miles, a huge biomass of microorganisms. Bacteria, undoubtedly archaea, microscopic fungi, whose ultimate energy source is chemosynthesis of materials available in the subterranean deposit. They don't depend upon ultimate photosynthetically derived energy. And if the Earth's surface were burned off, then they probably would survive. And then after a few billion years, perhaps, reemerge as multicellular organisms and plants and animals of a whole new creation, and finally something like us, and then the cycle would start all over again. It's really interesting as to what is still out there, and I cannot emphasize enough the need for us to press on into exploring what's on this earth. In the case, the political point I'd like to make is that if we discovered life on Mars, and then after a little while our ecstatic exobiologists said that they had now a grip on about 10% of the species, that's what the grip is we have on Earth's species, you know, Earth's biodiversity, I'm sure Congress would pass hundreds of millions or billions quickly to explore the other 90%. A billion doesn't mean very much to Congress these days. But to get this, but I take note, the total amount, this was about 5 years ago when I got the estimate together, the total amount spent on exploring the planet's surface fundamentally, you know, in diagnosing in this manner on the Earth's biodiversity by all sources, private and government, in the United States was between 150 and 200 million. Well, that's chump change, and I think indicates the a certain imbalance in or poor or questionable priorities in how we are funding research.
The granddaddy of Earth biodiversity, E. O. Wilson, speaking at the Harvard Medical School on February 16, 2006, a speech called Biodiversity and Conservation.